Apple takes Samsung to court.
And the U.S. Treasury Secretary heads to Europe to make sure all the recent optimism turns into action. Hey, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Monday, July the 30th. Coming up, I'm going to talk with Larry Summers, who was President Obama's former top economic advisor. He was also the Treasury Secretary under President Clinton. And we're going to speak about whether the debate over income inequality needs to be reframed, and the debate should be about equality of opportunity.
Sounds interesting. Our regular guest, Alan Sloan, will be by as well, and he digs up his very first column for Newsweek magazine in 1995, and we will marvel at how little has changed. That's coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
After years of tussling, lawyers for the two biggest smartphone producers in the world will finally be in federal court in San Jose, California today. Samsung, their number one, is being sued by Apple, which is the second biggest smartphone producer, believe it or not.
Apple is asking for more than $2 billion in damages, as well as an injunction to stop Samsung from selling its tablets and smartphones. Marketplace's Queena Kim reports.
Apple claims Samsung products copy the iPad and the iPhone's design. And Apple has a patent on those designs, which includes
the button placed on the bottom, a large screen, rounded corners, and a rectangular shape.
Colleen Chen is a law professor at Santa Clara University. And Samsung's comeback? No, Apple, you're the copycat.
Samsung's rejoinder is, you only can get a patent over something that's new, and other people had this similar idea before you.
The lawsuit signals that design patents are emerging as the newest weapon in the patent wars, and Apple has a big arsenal. Robin Feldman is a law professor at UC Hastings. She says Apple even has a patent for clean lines.
It's worth asking whether we should be giving so much power for the kinds of things that we give design patents for.
Because in the hands of a powerful company like Apple, Feldman says design patents could squash competitors and innovation. I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Over the weekend, comments by the leaders of Germany and Italy fueled optimism in Europe. They were backing up the head of the European Central Bank, who had promised to do whatever it takes to keep the European debt crisis from spinning out of control. U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is in Europe today, and he's got meetings with Mario Draghi, the ECB president, and Germany's finance minister. Marketplace's London Bureau Chief Stephen Beard is with us from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So what is Geithner pushing for today?
Well, he wants the European Central Bank to deliver on its promise and do what it takes to save the euro, most probably by pumping money into the market on a gigantic scale. Geithner could apply a bit of pressure through the International Monetary Fund. The fund has played a key role in combating the crisis. The US could threaten to veto that role, and that would certainly get the attention of the Europeans.
There is plenty of optimism in Europe today, but we have had optimism before. There is this time any different?
Well, investors seem more optimistic this time. But as you say, there are plenty of skeptics who say we've heard all this talk before about doing what it takes to save the euro. Mm-hmm. Sony Kapoor of the European think tank called Redefine says what it will take will be very unpopular, especially with the German taxpayers.
The measures needed to restore full confidence in Spain and Italy require a commitment of financial resources that is so large that the political appetite for that does not exist.
We'll probably have to wait until Geithner's gone home to see whether this is a turning point. All eyes will be on the European Central Bank at its regular meeting on Thursday to see if it does wheel out the big bazooka.
Stephen Beard in London, thanks very much.
Okay, Jeff.
Quick check of what the markets have been up to as we speak to you this morning. In Asia, markets closed mixed. The Nikkei up 0.8%. China was mixed. Down in Shanghai, lots of Chinese companies still turning in poor earnings. In Hong Kong, on the other hand, HSBC, the big bank, had some profits that impressed some people. And so the market's up there. That is despite their recent revelations about money laundering. Still lots of trouble there. Europe also looking to have a good day at this hour. Optimism continues.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Jeff, because last week and the first part of last week, the markets were just going down, down, down. And it was all said to be about concerns about Europe. And then all of a sudden, those comments that you just talked about with Stephen regarding the ECB ready to do whatever it takes to keep the euro together. That just changed everybody's mind. So there's going to be a lot of people watching to see what happens later this week, both at the ECB and at the Fed, and whether these monetary policymakers can live up to these very high expectations.
And our Stephen Beard in London, talking about that at the time, said there's plenty of skepticism about whether those words mean much, but investors apparently still riding that wave.
Well, the Federal Reserve Board is going to meet this week, and the buzz is that Chairman Ben Bernanke is considering some new tools to stimulate economic growth, perhaps using interest rates to encourage banks to take some risks with their money. One way to do that is to make the interest rate negative, as Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports.
The interest rate we're talking about here is the one the Fed offers banks to hold something called excess reserves. That's the extra money banks keep just in case a whole bunch of people decide to withdraw cash all at once. As a safety measure during the financial crisis, the Fed was offering a bit of interest on those reserves, a sort of reward for being cautious, according to Loyola Marymount economist James Devine.
Which means that they're not lending out that money.
And that's become its own problem, because as you may have noticed, these days it's hard for anyone to get a loan, to buy a house or start a business or do something, anything that might stimulate the economy. So what the Fed could do now, says University of Oregon economist Tim Dewey, is lower the interest rate on those reserves.
And in theory, you could make that a negative number.
Meaning, basically, the Fed would be charging banks for keeping too many reserves, which might goose them to start lending again. The risk with this tool, it might discourage banks from keeping any money at all in the Federal Reserve, and that could cause a whole other set of problems. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Boeing has been having a few nightmares lately with its Dreamliner. The 787 Dreamliner is Boeing's flagship airplane of the future, fuel-efficient, quieter cabin, and American-made. And it was near the Charleston, South Carolina assembly plant that something got sucked into a 787's engine on Saturday, apparently sparked a grass fire on the runway. And that follows last week when All Nippon Airways temporarily grounded its 787s to fix an engine problem. Those engines, by the way, are made by General Electric. Brian Foley is an airline analyst and president of Brian Foley Associates. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So walking into work this morning at Boeing, do you think there's a great deal of concern there?
Absolutely. That is something to keep an eye on and find out what the root cause of that problem was. There is some GE engines currently flying with Japan Airlines now, so they, of course, want to make sure this isn't a systemic problem and try to find the cause and make good on it.
Is this kind of thing fairly typical for the rollout of a new aircraft?
Normally, you'd have these kind of bugs behind you, but then again, it's a new machine, and sometimes things can't be foreseen, but you really want to try to shake these things out during the major flight test process and not just before delivery to a customer.
Of course, we're all standing outside the process here. We don't know the details of exactly what happened, but do you see anything that air passengers might be worried about?
Well, the good regulators are keeping an eye on this, and once they get some indication of what may have happened, they'll be there to advise the public if it's still safe to fly. But they're in that process now of, I'm sure, looking through the engine and trying to find out the cause and to see if it is a widespread concern or just a one-off chance that happened to that airplane.
This particular plane was headed for Air India. Do you think they might be having second thoughts?
I'm not sure about second thoughts, but I'm sure it has their attention. You know, an airline has to plan ahead when they have new equipment coming in, so it could leave the airline in a lurch if they don't have an alternative plan if there is some additional delay.
Aviation analyst Brian Foley, thanks a lot.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Now to a little snafu you may have heard about at the Olympics. Officials accidentally showed a South Korean flag instead of a North Korean flag at a soccer match.
Yikes. If you're going to mess up two countries,
yeah, those are
two,
tricky.
That's a mess with.
Well, one company, though, is taking advantage of the mistake, Jeff. A British chain that sells eyeglasses has put out advertisements that say if only officials had come in for an eye test, they would have been able to tell the difference between the two flags, and this whole thing could have been avoided.
Very, very clever. Well, we haven't done a whole lot in the Olympics today, but let's have a little fun with them now. If you think you're excited about the Olympics, are you, Jeremy? Are you excited about the Olympics?
Yeah, I watched the opening ceremonies, and I've seen a couple of the events, and it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, well, and we've been reporting a lot on logistical problems and security problems and people in London who are frustrated. But if you think people in London are apathetic about the Olympics, just listen to this Olympic greeter who was recording reported by cell phone outside this weekend's events in London.
We're excited. London 2012. My mouth is dry. I need some water, but I'm still talking because I'm that happy. I'm going to overcome it.
Okay, so Jeremy, you might think somebody would run off and pull her off of the lifeguard's chair where she's sitting. But no, this goes on for 4 or 5 minutes.
Wow.
It's apparently unsupervised or totally cool. I don't know. Anyway, clearly we have entered the viral videos from the 30th Olympiad. There's another great one out there right now of a gymnast's parents watching her routine. It's just classic.
You know, I think that if it hasn't already gone viral, the thing from the opening ceremonies with Mr. Bean, did you see that?
Yeah, it was great.
Fantastic. I hope that does go viral. And yeah, that was very funny.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
Well, Jeff, there are 99 days left until the presidential election, if you can believe it.
I'm ticking them off of the wall.
Okay, yeah. That's right. You can take down the three digits, and now we're down to two. And if you could sum up the themes that have really defined this election so far, one of them would probably have to be income inequality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on both sides are really talking about this issue. And Larry Summers, who was President Obama's top economic advisor, he was the former Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, says that is the wrong debate to be having, that in fact we should be talking about inequality of opportunity. Well, for our Midday Extra, we are joined now by the man himself, Larry Summers. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, what do you mean when you say we need to focus on inequality of opportunity in America?
It's probably inevitable, given the global economy, that there's going to be substantial inequality. There's going to be returns to people with extraordinary skills, to extraordinary entrepreneurship. We want people who achieve extraordinary things. If America had more people like Steve Jobs, we'd be an even greater country, but we'd probably have more inequality. But it's much harder to justify the inequalities of opportunity that exist in our country today. We should try to mitigate inequality, but it's imperative that we have a system in which everybody has a fair chance to succeed if that system's going to be legitimate. And unfortunately, we probably have seen the first generation when the linkages between the success of parents and the success of children may actually be getting stronger rather than weaker.
So what's the answer then?
There's no single magic bullet. We've got to do much better at educating those from less advantaged backgrounds. That starts in preschool. It goes to strengthening public schools. It goes to the kind of after-school programs and summer programs that we have. It goes to the quality of the people we draw into the teaching profession. We've got to make sure that everyone's got a fair chance at college and a fair chance at the best college education they can possibly receive. That goes to controlling the growth in tuition costs. That goes to the kind of financial aid that we provide. That goes to admissions policies, which too often reward things that only very fortunate parents can provide with their children. Extensive training in a particular sport, or expensive summer programs. It goes to the way we help children prepare for the college admissions process. You know, some of the least diverse classes in the United States are those in some of the SAT prep schools. We need to support the activity of preparing everybody to put their best foot forward when they're applying to college.
Well, do you think the government needs to guarantee every child in America a public education that goes through college the way that they currently can do through high school?
I'm not sure that college as we classically think of it is going to be what every child is going to want to do. Indeed, more than a quarter of students right now don't get all the way through high school without dropping out. But I think we need to have that option more available with less economic burden than has been the case historically.
What about the things, though, that you can't control from Washington, like, for instance, what happens in the home, what the parents do, what the choices that the kid makes?
Not everything is amenable to public policy. The government can't read to a child before the child goes to sleep. What the government can do is assure that working families have opportunities to earn reasonable incomes. It can strive to create an economy in which people who want to work are able to work. It can create an economy in which those who suffer dislocations, whether it's from international trade or whether it's from the economic downturn, receive appropriate assistance. These are all steps that contribute to more equality of opportunity.
And I'm sure that your political opponents on the right would listen to this and say this is more government involvement. Wouldn't a free enterprise system be the best way to ensure that everyone has equality of opportunity?
They probably would make some argument of that kind, but they wouldn't be right. The market left to its own devices is not going to get poor children to college. The market left to its own devices is not going to help those least fortunate communities provide decent public education for their children. The market left to its own devices is going to choose existing businesses over new businesses. There's much that government needs to do to create more equal opportunity.
Well, you were the top economic advisor under President Obama. Do you think that he has done enough? And do you think that you did enough on this front?
I think we took some very important steps. The largest increase in federal financial aid for higher education in the last 40 years was part of the original Economic Recovery Act. The steps to make tax cuts refundable and expand the earned income tax credit, which helps lower income families, strengthen the incentives for individual initiative. We pushed for things that would make a real difference in putting people back to work, like substantial increases in infrastructure investment. And the president didn't get everything that he wanted from the Congress in that regard because the opposition wouldn't permit it, though we did make progress. So there's certainly much, much more to be done. But I think if you look at those steps on college affordability, if you look at the steps that were taken in Race to the Top to strengthen public education, if you look at the steps that were taken to provide tax relief to lower-income families, to cushion the blow of the recession through expanding unemployment insurance, President Obama has done more to support equal opportunity than any administration in substantially more than a generation.
Now, all of this ties, of course, into the debate over taxing the rich and whether they should pay a few percent more or less in taxes. Do you think that we can ever come to agreement on that? This is a debate that's been going on for 20 years or so.
I think that what people need to recognize is just this. The top tax rate was 90% when Dwight Eisenhower was president. Top tax rate after Lyndon Johnson's famous 1964 tax cut was 70%. The top tax rate during most of President Reagan's term was 50%. The top tax rate during Bill Clinton's term, when the economy had its greatest boom in the last 40 years, was 39%. It strains credulity to believe that at a time when we've got larger budget deficits than we've ever had before, somehow it will do grievous damage to the economy to restore tax rates, not to where they were with President Eisenhower, not to where they were with Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, not even to where they were with President Reagan, but only to where they were with President Clinton. I think that's an elementary kind of judgment about where we need to go as a country in the context of addressing our long-run challenges.
Okay, before I let you go, I think people will be interested to hear your thoughts on a couple of pieces of information about our economy right now. Do you think the housing market is at the bottom?
It's hard to know. It's much closer to the bottom than it was 2 years ago, and the moment will come when there's a turn. I think it's a real possibility if nothing else like developments in Europe disrupts the economy.
How concerned are you with the fiscal cliff?
If nothing is done and massive tax increases and massive spending cuts take place on January 1st, it will have devastating consequences for the economy and make a recession almost inevitable.
Whose fault is it that the European debt crisis is still weighing on the markets week after week after week?
Some of it lies in the original design of the European system. Some of it lies in the fact that European policymakers have not been able to take steps sufficient to get ahead of the problem rather than simply try to manage the problem.
And finally, I know this is something that you've had to look into while you were in the administration. Is it time to break up the banks? We've had just scandal after scandal.
It's clear that we need to look at a lot of issues in financial policy, and there are clearly excesses that will need to be addressed. It's far from clear that breaking up the banks is the right solution.
So you wouldn't do that?
I think we got to study all the issues, and certainly what has come out, the continuing scandals around LIBOR, around money laundering, around rogue trading. These are all alarming problems. So I don't think anyone should suppose that we have all financial issues in hand. But I also think it's a mistake to assume that somehow breaking up the banks would be a panacea. You know, the lesson that was drawn from the S&L crisis was that the financial system was excessively fragmented. That was the lesson that was also drawn from the Depression. The other lesson that most experts have drawn from recent experience is that Canada, which has a much more robust system of financial regulation than most other countries, has been a model. But it has a financial system that is heavily consolidated. So I agree with those who are dissatisfied with where we stand with respect to the financial system right now, but I'm not sure that when you analyze it closely, you'll find that breaking it up works so well. After all, if you think about catalysts for the crisis we've just had, Bear Stearns and Lehman were already broken up institutions. They were relatively small relative to the overall economy. They were specialized in investment banking. The remedies that advocates of breakup suggest wouldn't have touched those situations at all. So I do think we need to be careful and thoughtful about finding the right approach. But too often, that translates into a council of complacency or a council of satisfaction with the status quo. And I think that is very much misguided.
You want to go back to Washington if President Obama is reelected?
I'm enjoying my life, my life in Boston, thinking and writing. So I'm very happy doing what I'm doing.
Well, Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, former top economic advisor to President Obama, now professor at Harvard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And by the way, tomorrow we're going to hear a totally different take on the inequality of opportunity question with Arthur Brooks of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute.
From that topic, appropriately perhaps, we'll now go to New Orleans, where one in seven African-American men is in jail, in prison, on probation, or on parole. And that kind of incarceration rate is making the city's poverty problem even worse.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
As part of our coverage of wealth and poverty, Marketplace's Shireen Marisol Meraji went to New Orleans to profile a group that's working to keep young people out of prison.
The Youth Empowerment Project's offices are in Central City, a part of New Orleans notorious for its high murder rate.
At least 75% of the people I knew is either in jail, and the other 15% probably be dead, you know.
20-year-old Darren Aldridge is a student at its GED program.
I became a part of it because I went to prison.
Aldridge went to jail on a gun charge, and a condition of his release was that he get his GED. About a decade ago, Melissa Sawyer was traveling all over Louisiana, working to get kids released early from juvenile detention.
What we were finding was there was no support system to help these kids be successful. Within about 18 months, six of the kids I was working closely with were shot and killed.
Sawyer says in some cases, jail was safer than the neighborhoods these kids were going home to. So she co-founded the Youth Empowerment Project. It helps kids adjust to life outside. Sawyer says only 7% of the young people she's worked with have gone back. But
I have young men coming through the doors asking our staff all the time, "Ms. Melissa, do you have a job? Do you have a job? Can you help me get a job?" And that is our biggest challenge.
Nationally, more than a third of young Black men are unemployed. Sawyer says she thinks that number is much higher because it doesn't count those who've never had a job. She says 80% of the young men who come to the Youth Empowerment Project, guys like Darren Aldridge, are looking for work. I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji for Marketplace.
So you weren't here last week for the fun, Jeremy, but we spent plenty of breath on Sandy Weill. I'm sure you heard about this.
Oh, yeah.
The former head of Citigroup. Back in the 90s, he fought for his bank and other banks to be able to grow huge and to get more complex. So last week, Weill goes on TV and he says, "It's time to break up the big banks." Quite a change of heart. Well, that inspired Alan Sloan, Fortune's senior editor at large, to do a bit of time traveling, you might say. Hello, Alan.
Good morning, Jeff.
We are so often talking about your latest column, but today you're going to take us way back to your very first column for Newsweek some 17, 18 years ago. What did you have to say?
Well, in March of 1995, I wrote that repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banking from commercial banking, was a terrible idea and we shouldn't do it.
And that ultimately did happen in 99?
That's right. And it begat Citigroup, which has not been a success, and begat all sorts of other problems.
And what were the fears that you articulated in 1995?
That combining these companies would combine two different businesses and no one knew how to manage one of them, let alone two of them, and these things would become big, enormous, sprawling. And this week, I think I'm going to take the victory run, you know, in the journalistic Olympics, if I can find enough laurel leaves.
But just to elaborate a bit on the things that were going on in 1995, it could be ripped from today's headlines.
It was all the same stuff, but the numbers were smaller and the names were different. But, you know, if you change the names, it would be exactly what's going on now.
So Sandy Weill, the former CEO of Citigroup, was one of those people who took full advantage of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and now he says the banks should be broken up. Do you feel vindicated? Do you think maybe he just finally picked up your column and read it?
Well, considering that he's the major reason Glass-Steagall was repealed, it's possible that he came late to righteousness. I don't think it's because of me, but if you like, I'll happily take credit.
Why do you think it was?
I think it was because he's a reasonably intellectually honest guy, is getting near the end of his, you know, time, and has a regret and wanted to express it.
Alan Sloan, Fortune Magazine senior editor-at-large. Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Senator Tom Harkin is out with a scathing report on for-profit colleges today. The Iowa Democrat says taxpayers invest billions of dollars a year in the schools through federal financial aid programs, but students often leave deep in debt with little to show for their investment. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, here's Amy Scott.
As chairman of the Senate Education Committee, Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin has spent 2 years investigating for-profit colleges. He says the committee uncovered a litany of abuses.
Exorbitant tuition,
aggressive recruiting practices, abysmal student outcomes, taxpayer dollars spent on marketing and profit. And these aren't exceptions. That is the norm.
For-profit colleges make most of their money from federal financial aid programs. Students get grants and loans from the government and use them to pay for school. In the 2009 and 10 school year, that amounted to $32 billion flowing to for-profit colleges. Harkin says the schools spend more of that money on marketing and recruiting than on instruction.
Federal money should be spent on education, not advertising, not recruiting, not lobbying.
The Association of Private Sector Colleges and Universities and Republicans on the Education Committee took issue with a number of the report's findings. For example, the industry says it has a higher graduation rate than reported. Harkin's report recommends several changes, including forbidding schools from using federal funding for marketing and recruiting. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, I know that you love lists of cities.
I'm sorry
that I happened to see this one before you because it's right up your alley. I've got a new survey from CareerBuilder.com that calls out the cities where people are most likely to swear at work.
Uh-huh.
Do you have any guesses? What would make people swear at
work? Oh, I don't know. New York? It's got to be high on the list,
You would think so, but here's what we've got. So number one, top of the list, with 62% of workers admitting to their potty mouths, I guess, Washington, D.C., is number one. Well, you know, the frustrations of working for the federal government, I guess I can see that.
I guess.
Followed kind of mysteriously, not far behind, by Denver, and then Chicago. And the major cities with the cleanest workplace language, New York and Philadelphia.
Huh. Well, it's pretty clean workplace language here in the New York office of Marketplace, but it also is in Los Angeles, although sometimes, you know, newsrooms get a little rowdy.
L.A. was right in the middle, yeah.
Well, one more thing before we go, Jeff. AOL reported its quarterly earnings last week, and there was an interesting number in there. 3 million.
Their revenues?
No, that's not their revenues. Oh. It's how many dial-up subscribers they still have.
What?
That's right. People are still paying for the old-fashioned AOL dial-up. And the funny thing was that was the best number in years because the company only lost 84,000 dial-up subscribers the previous quarter.
Huh.
Now, my only hope when seeing this is that that is not some indication of a trend that we are now going to move back into dial-up internet. For the sake of all mankind, I hope that that is not where we're going.
This may be picked up as a campaign issue, I suppose. Could this be a quality of opportunity in action?
That's right, perhaps.
To have dial-up, that kind of stunts your quality of opportunity. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.